So for those of you who might be interested in the Park City Municipal CARES grant access, a Q&A will be held this morning starting at 9 o'clock. You can find out more by going online to parkcity.org. The session will be held with Park City Mayor Andy Bierman and City Council Member Max Doylny. The city has, $2.2 million from the State and Federal CARE Act assistance that will be open to small businesses and nonprofits, but there's a quick closure on this. The grant application closes on November 9th. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Mike Kohler is the Republican candidate running for Utah House District 54. He'll talk to us a little bit about his campaign. And then finally, Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson will be previewing tomorrow's Planning Commission agenda, which includes another look at the Park City Mountain Resort base parking lots. Stay tuned. A Wyoming court recently struck down a rule preventing oil and gas companies from deliberately venting or burning off excess natural gas. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on what that means for the environment and what the future of that rule might look like.
It's called venting and flaring, and it's the practice energy companies use to burn off excess natural gas or release it into the atmosphere during the extraction of oil. Energy companies claim there is no economical way for them to capture and use the gas. The gas is a byproduct of fracking, a term you may have heard in the news recently in regards to the presidential election. Fracking is the practice of using hydraulic pressure in order to access deep pockets of oil or natural gas. Jason O'Neill is with Accountable U.S., a nonprofit organization that focuses on government corruption, and says of the two, venting is worse for the environment, but flaring is not much better, as both release harmful gases into the atmosphere.
There's two parts to this process. One is the direct venting of that gas, so that would be just released directly into the atmosphere. A lot of that happens right when fracking occurs, when they're drilling the well. But then there's also the flaring of it, which is a little less impactful in that that flaring means that that methane is then burned by the oil and gas company, but then released into the air. So while it does reduce some of the methane, it does convert it into CO2, which we also know is a harmful greenhouse gas.
The practice of venting and flaring was curbed in 2016 by the Obama administration's methane and waste prevention rule. The rule required oil and gas producers to take steps to reduce the amount of waste gas produced during the extraction of fossil fuels. The rule was immediately challenged in court by energy companies, and according to the Bureau of Land Management, which was in charge of enforcing the rule, it was never fully implemented after the Trump administration took over in January 2017. In early October, a Wyoming district court struck down the rule. O'Neill says the excess gas could be used for energy, but again, energy companies say they just can't justify the expense of capturing and finding a use for the gas.
When we look at kind of the broader picture, this is energy that can be used to heat homes. That they can be used in other processes, other industrial processes as well. But, when it has been brought forward about how we're going to manage this, industry has stood steadfast in saying that this is uneconomical for them to conserve.
So what does the future hold for the waste prevention rule? O'Neill says a lot of it hinges on the upcoming election. The Trump administration has not shown a willingness to enact regulations on the energy industry and has rolled back several Obama-era policies aimed at curbing emissions. Joe Biden said his administration would tackle climate change and work to transition the United States off of fossil fuels and on to more renewable sources of energy like wind and solar. Biden's opponents say that's too expensive and it would destroy the American oil and gas industry. President Trump's critics say climate change is too dire of a situation to ignore. What is certain, however, is the fight over the future of fossil fuels is not going away anytime soon. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Summit County Council will begin meeting at 12:45 tomorrow. On the phone with a preview, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you'll start with an update from the Junior Livestock Sale from this year's fair, really the only fair event that was held. The numbers, as expected, are down with fewer participants and sales down by double digits, especially for lamb and pork. But Summit County also provided each exhibitor some $700 using the CARES Act fund. So it really looks like they came out ahead here.
Well, I think they came out a little bit towards even or less, according to the staff report. But, you know, it was given the allocation that the county got of CARES Act money, it seemed like a very appropriate expenditure, especially in order to even out the expenditure. So we've got, you know, the good news from our story or our staff report around this item is that pavement condition, because of condition maintenance over the last few years, has really increased our pavement schedule or allowed us to advance pavement maintenance to a point where we're gaining some of the backlog that it was experienced in probably the last 10 years. So some very budgeting over the last years in order in revenues. And just, we're also...
But I can't hear what you're saying. Well, East Canyon State Park in northeastern Utah was recently designated an International Dark Sky Park to become the 14th in Utah to earn that designation. That's a classification that means that East Canyon's nighttime skies are free enough of light pollution and have an exceptional or distinguished quality of starry nights and nocturnal environment. That's according to the nonprofit that grants the classification. Park manager Chris Hiramoto says the work to get the park tabbed with the dark sky designation took about a half a decade. That included changing out old park lights for new dark sky-friendly features with soft tones, full-cut off-shielding motion detectors, as well as timers. We're going to give this another chance on the phone. We've got Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, and we were talking about the capital projects, including some major road projects, and he had started to say something about the pavement schedule.
So is this any better, first of all?
That sounds better right now.
Okay, perfect. So, you know, what I was saying is that over the last few years, we've been able to budget proper amounts in pavement maintenance, which has actually increased the quality of our pavement over time. That's one of the good news stories from this. And, you know, even though we're experiencing revenue challenges, we expect to be able to put a healthy amount of budget towards pavement maintenance over the next year in order to keep that schedule going and making sure that we don't fall behind. That's one of the areas that the council has been very adamant about keeping going, even when we have downturns in revenue. We're also talking about, within this capital discussion, another discussion about a bond program to take advantage of low interest rates that are going on right now. We have a bond that's maturing this year, so we've made our last payment, which frees up some room in order to consider advancing some projects within our current facilities master plan, mainly projects around public works, public safety, and then some subsequent remodels if we were to build a new facility in the 40 corridor.
What kind of public safety building are we talking about?
Well, within our facilities master plan, our public safety building, or where the sheriffs operates out of, they've been operating there for about 20 years. The space has become very challenged as far as being able to expand at all. You'll recall a couple of years ago that we moved, we merged dispatch between Park City and Summit County and moved that all into the county building. So our facilities master plan contemplated building some capacity for evidence storage, as well as administrative space, so the administration of the sheriff's office could move out of that building and free up some space for patrol and investigations and dispatch and those types of things to grow in the future. So it made some sense since that was a high priority project within our facilities master plan to program that in at this time.
So are we talking a separate building then from the jail?
It could be a separate building. And the campus that we have there does have some expansion space, but you'll know that it's also adjacent to the 125 acres that the county purchased within the last year and a half. So we've got some space to grow over there. The space that's on the current property is on the side where the courts are, so we might reserve that for future court expansion if we need that. But we're not sure yet. We're going to, as part of this bond, we're going to go through the process of some master planning of our properties in that area in order to figure out where we want to build.
Okay. Well, I thought we were talking about major road projects. I mean, are we going to see anything happen at the Promontory Silver Summit interchange?
The bond program is strictly around facilities. We also have bonds out around road projects, and you'll recall that the Jeremy Ranch interchange was funded by a portion of that. The Silver Summit interchange is one of the ones that is certainly high on the list to do something about. Right now we've got some corridor preservation money programmed within the budget to do that, and that would mean, you know, for corridor preservation, that's our code word for right-of-way acquisition. So there's probably going to be some expansion of that interchange and its need for space. We don't know yet, since we haven't gotten deep in with UDOT on the expansion of that interchange or its chain or any kind of changes for it, what it's going to need. That's going to be partly driven by what kind of development happens in the area. And you'll recall that there's some projects making their way through the process right now. First on trying to rezone, and then an eventual project. And then, of course, the growth of Silver Creek Village plays into that as well.
Sure. We're talking about that SIG mixed-use parcel?
That's correct.
Yeah. What about the Silver Creek Connector Road? Is that going to get started here soon?
Yeah. In fact, we're going to review a preliminary design on that, which kind of starts the process of setting right-of-way for that this week. We want to take a look at that with a couple of our council members to make sure that we're in the right neighborhood as far as the original design. At that point, we can start reviewing that with the service area 3, with residents in the area, especially residents or property owners that are going to be affected by right-of-way purchases. We'll go through that process and start to bring that design public at the same time that we're starting to look at right-of-way and having those discussions with property owners. Don't know whether we'll hit the construction season in 2021, but we're programmed for it from a budget perspective. If everything lines up correctly and we're able to start that project, we may have start on pieces of it. But I think you'll see that over a couple of year period.
All right. An update on the CARES Act funding, almost $6 million, it looks like, paid to Summit County. Has all of the money been spent?
It has not all been spent. As you would expect with when you get that large allocation of dollars over a short period of time, you know, we made some initial plans when the first $2 million was allocated to the county and in the county books. And, you know, some of the things either turned out to be continued to be priorities or didn't, as well as, you know, some of the original allocations towards specific projects. Some came in more expensive, some came in less expensive. So we've had to make some changes and make some decisions along the way. Some of the big ones, you know, we've added extra money to some of our grant programs for nonprofits and businesses. We've collaborated with two of our school districts to cover some of their expenses throughout the pandemic. And so that's a couple of examples where we've had to make some changes.
Yeah, it sounds like the payments on this were all screwy. I mean, it sounded like the county thought they were getting so much money and then didn't, and then you'd have to rebudget. Why so much confusion?
Well, I mean, I think it's not so much confusing. First of all, we really didn't know going from, you know, they kind of allocated in thirds. So we got $2 million in the summer, we got $2 million in the fall, and we're getting our last $2 million right now. And we didn't know along the way whether we were going to get the next allocation, because the state continued to say, we expect to give it to you, but if other priorities come up in the state, we might have to change those amounts. And then, of course, cities got allocated, especially cities with tourism impact, got allocated a large allocation this fall, because some areas of the state weren't able to expend the amounts they were allocated. So, you know, I think we've just had to remain fluid throughout this and do the best we can of getting these dollars out in the community where they need to go. I mean, we've really concentrated on trying to make sure that we're preparing for a time when we're not going to have federal money available to us. So especially in the areas of PPE and cleansing supplies and things that will help our businesses. At the same time, you know, we have to expend all these funds by the end of November, or the state won't meet the federal government's rule of having it all expended by the end of December.
Okay, and if you have money left over, where would it go?
Well, it would go back to the state. We're not expecting to have any money left over. We're working very hard as the county and with our cities, who also received allocations, to make sure that those dollars stay here in Summit County.
And at 325, a continued discussion of the Dakota Pacific Project. No action is expected. It comes to the council with a split vote from the Planning Commission against the proposal, 5-2. It sounds like this conversation will focus on the density, the volumetrics, and the massing. We have heard that this is less dense than what was approved in 2008. It's just got different density, more residential than office space. And I noted that the staff report also says that the 2008 development agreement has not stated maximum density. So what is the original entitlement here? I mean, if there's no maximum, can they ask for more?
I suppose they could. And, you know, of course, that, you know, I think it's a little bit more complex on that. I think there would be some, especially the original folks that worked on this from the private sector would say that they feel that there was a maximum. It's just not determined in the same way that other developments are. I think that's one of the big questions that the council brought up during their original hearing of this a few weeks ago. They want to understand this better so that they know what they're allowing and what they're not allowing as they talk about this. And to help them make some determination of what seems fair based on the original entitlement. And I think there's some in the council that are just not clear on what that original entitlement is. Plus, they want to bring some public light to that.
Yeah. So do you think that based on the discussion that we'll have a better understanding of that?
I think we'll have a better understanding. I'm not sure that we're going to have agreement on that. Well, that remains to be seen. But certainly, you know, those that purchased the property and the development rights along with that feel that they had something there that was worthy of purchase. So I think they're going to be defending that especially.
All right. Coming up after tomorrow's discussion, we'll have three more work sessions, including affordable housing, transportation, and mobility, and then an economic analysis. A tentative public hearing has been scheduled on Monday, November 23rd, the Monday before Thanksgiving. So that seems like an odd time.
I would say that schedule is very fluid. You know, we're trying to lay out some expectation. Not sure that the Monday before Thanksgiving is a great day to hold a public hearing in Summit County. It'd be kind of like doing it at the day before Christmas Eve, perhaps. So that schedule is based on what we know the council wants to know about right now. I expect that there's going to be more work sessions on this than is currently scheduled. So it's very possible that we could see public hearings either in December or even past the holiday time into January before we get to that point.
Okay. At 4:40, just wanted to make a mention that the County Council will be honoring Marty Gee for her 34 years of service. This woman's been around with water, with the Summit Park Water Department before it merged with Mountain Regional. I think been serving with Mountain Regional since.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually amazing to read through the proclamation and knowing Marty now for the past 6 years. I didn't realize the whole history of what she has brought to Summit County in regards to water. I mean, if you read through this, you realize she is our current, she is the key to our current water system, and how we're interconnected, how we're serving each other, how well we're served, the companies that are involved with that and the public entities. She was the catalyst around that. And, 34 years is great, but if you read it, you realize that she even volunteered a year before she started working for the organization. So it's really 35 years. And it's just amazing what Marty has brought to our county, and we're gonna miss that input. But she's certainly trained a lot of people to follow in our footsteps.
All right. And then finally, back for more is the continued discussion, possible action on a deck extension. It's hard to believe that a deck could take it so much time from so many people. They're basically asking to double the size of a back deck from 6 to 12 feet here. And I guess, looking at the staff report, I'm like, what's the concern? It sounds like many of the other deck and property owners have expanded their decks. Why would this one be so different?
It's not simple, and that's why the council has deliberated over it so long. It's a problem of whether the plat shows the right type of ownership of the property in order to allow that. And even I can't describe the complexity of that, but. I think it's a difficult enough issue that the council has struggled over, just as they do any time that they feel like they're setting precedent that would apply somewhere else or could be misapplied somewhere else. They're giving it the scrutiny that it deserves in that respect. We can certainly joke over the amount of time spent per foot of deck, but. This is a complex issue, and this is what the council is here to contemplate.
Sure. So it's not being expanded over the common space like the others have. Is that why this is different?
Well, it's different because of the type of common space that it is. And again, I'm not the part of the legal conversations to really describe that in depth. But there is a contradiction in the type of common space that is being contemplated here.
Okay. Tom, anything else you want to add?
That's all for today, Leslie.
All right. Thanks for your time. That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, with Republican Tim Quinn not seeking re-election to District 53 of the Utah House of Representatives, the seat's wide open. On the phone is the man looking to replace him, Republican Mike Kohler. He's being challenged by Democrat Megan Miller, with whom I'll be speaking tomorrow on the Local News Hour. But good morning to you, Mike. Thanks for joining us. Hi, you there, Mike?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Good morning.
Great. Thank you. Let's see. Why don't you start by telling us just a little bit about yourself and why you're running for the Utah State Legislature?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm a lifelong resident of Midway, been involved in politics down in this way for a long time, raised my family here, and most of my kids still live here in the Wasatch County area. My mom grew up in Park City, so I have a lot of involvement and acquaintances over there as well in both communities. Was a member of the Wasatch County Council for many years and got involved in politics, working with not only local politics, with the legislature. And when Tim decided not to run, I figured it'd be a good chance to try and take a shot at it, because I've been involved from the outside and I'd like a seat on the inside to try and make a better impact on how they affect us and our lives here.
In one of the mailings that was paid for by the Utah Republican Party, it says that you are for lower taxes. So were you a supporter of Tim Quinn's efforts to shift the sales taxes to services as we become more of a service economy?
I was like a lot of people watching that, more as a, how it might affect us than in looking to make sure that it dropped taxes, et cetera. I think the big problem that had, number one, is the problem that it's trying to solve has a few years left, so it's not an emergency, but it is something that likely will continue to be a problem over time. Secondly, the process that they went through, and this is my opinion as I watched it, was, and certainly the people that were doing it inside probably thought differently, but it was definitely rushed, in my opinion, from a point of view of public input, not given enough time, and certainly input, now they, or public involvement. They did go around the state and have some group gatherings around the state where they made presentations, but again, as it went through, it seemed to me to be lacking in public input. It also had some intrinsic problems with who would be taxed and how much, and pyramiding. I mean, there's a lot of things that went in, pyramiding being an individual service being taxed and in several levels before it got to the final consumer that never did get finalized, and in the end, obviously, the one they did pass under threat of a referendum then was withdrawn. So that's something that's going to have to be taken up. When I say drop in taxes, I think the state takes a lot of money out of our pockets already. Certainly the pandemic's caused a little bit of a problem with the budget, and a little bit's probably not probably an understatement. But that said, there's a lot that's got to happen to solve the budget problem from the state, part of the what the pandemic's done. But certainly the rework of the tax rules and the policy will impact businesses and individuals for years. No, that's what I want to be part of.
Yeah, so you agree with the premise that tax reform needs to happen?
I do. I'm not necessarily on board with that it has to switch over to services at this time, and how that's going to impact everybody. It's just a broad, broad brush that you're talking about there, and individual rules make a big difference. So there's a lot more to talk about than just the generalities of what you say. But yes, I think it has to take place, and it'll take place over the course of several years, and the public's got to be more involved.
The flyer also says that Mike is a good listener. And with the, let's talk about when the state legislature tried to undo Park City's plastic bag ban, like it did undid the school impact fees that the school district put into effect some 20 years ago. Who will Mike Kohler listen to, the constituents or your colleagues?
Yeah, as a representative of Wasatch County and Park City area, I will represent the constituents. I will never pledge that thing, this part of it. I would never get in the way of local control. And if Park City wants to have that limit, then I'm fine with that, and I will support it 100% and push for it. That's one thing the legislature, in my opinion, has done wrong in the past and continues to do, and certainly the federal government has its own issues as well, where government in central parts try to impose their will on local areas. And I think local control is best, and that's what I'd support, and I would definitely support what you're talking about as far as the bag ban, and leave it where it belongs in local hands of local councils.
Yeah, and where that kind of gets sticky is, you know, where you say that you support private property rights. Again, a good example of that is the now empty Utah Film Studios, really just, you know, the entryway to Park City. According to the Utah Ombudsman Office that had a look at this, this was supposed to be a 2-acre development that included a motel and a gas station. Now we have this behemoth empty production studios with future plans that allow for a hotel and retail businesses. Again, this was forced on Park City by the Utah legislature, the squeaky wheel being the property owner at the time, Greg Erickson. So again, I mean, it's like, who will you listen to? I mean, you support Greg Erickson's property rights. He's not a member, a resident of Park City. So do you listen to the town of 8,000 who didn't want this, or the you know, the sole property owner?
Interesting question, but it's an easy answer as well. That should have been a local control decision. The legislature their history is replete with powerful people influencing, either through lobbyists or otherwise, local legislators state legislatures to make a decision that affects a local piece of ground or a local situation or policy. I mean, certainly comes in when you talk about hideout. I think that should have been left alone as well. But in this case, certainly property rights are important, but there's no reason, and in my opinion, no, certainly not a good idea for the state legislature to impose its will on a little spot like that in an individual, as far as state legislation. Now, there's a lot of cases where it may be different, but certainly this one is one that I agree with you, and I would listen to the locals.
Yeah.
Local control is always better. That's where people know what's happening.
And regarding, well, let's talk a little bit about hideout. You say that that's something you didn't support, that the legislature approving House Bill 359, allowing a municipality to annex from another county?
Well, what the law did is it basically blocked Summit County from being part of the discussion. I think the annexation part is a separate discussion, but I think the time has come, and certainly we should have been and have been in small parts, as when I was in the council, in small focused incidences, working collaboratively either on transportation or annexation or other planning around. And the Jordanelle's kind of a focus of it because it's basically a clean slate, or it was 20 years ago, and is starting to build out. So, in my opinion, the legislature should not have changed the rules of the game there and allowed Summit County, Park City was already involved as well, and hideout some of these developers to, if they wanted to talk about it, let's talk about it, but not block one from participating and change the rules as much as they did.
And when did you serve on the Wasatch County Council? Was this when hideout, when the developer of hideout was looking to the council for some approval and then found another legislator to get a town like hideout approved?
Yeah, it was a similar thing. I was on the council. I was there from 99 through 16. And that was a rule similar to this one, basically, a legislative change that happened in the late hours of the legislature, where some rule language was changed, not watched carefully and missed, and certainly I was one of them. We were involved a little bit, but and got it changed right at the end, but they left a little bit of the 60-day kind of rule in it so that they had a chance to finish, which I think is another problem. But it basically allowed the developer to create a town imposing the township and whatever rules they wanted on people that lived in the area without a vote for 2 years. Now, we eventually got that changed to where if that happens now, it still could happen, but the people that are going to be circled in and brought into that town get an immediate vote whether they want to do it or not. That would have changed. This wouldn't have happened. That being said, we are where we are, and hideout has its issues based on the history and based on the desires of the original developer, and they've got to work through them. But it seems to me, from my point of view, this was kind of manipulated by some money and leverage from some wealthy people to give some an advantage to some and other and not to others. And that's what I oppose. They should be working together, forcing the locals to not only make the decision, but work together for the good of the whole.
I also want to ask you about education. You say you support education. What does that look like?
Well, education's an interesting thing because of all the rules. We have the amendment on the books this year, and I support that for a couple of reasons. It does expand the use of the income tax, and it gives the legislature a few more tools, but it's more nuanced than that, but I'm supporting what they do. What I'm pushing for in legislation towards education is, number one, make sure funding, which is going to be a challenge, obviously, with the state having its issues now with general revenue. But I would like to see us, at least in Wasatch County and Park City, try and I think it's a statewide phenomenon, try to get our teacher pay up a little bit. Administration generally is covered with their, you know, they can live on what they get, and I'm not terribly impressed with fancy buildings. I think we spend more than we need to on some of those. But I think we need to put more into our starting teachers and raise their pay so they can afford to live in the communities where they serve. They're great assets to us, and we need to be giving them a little bit more respect and pay and help them out a little. The same goes for law enforcement. Starting law enforcement gets paid very, very low wages and often have to travel to work in Wasatch or Summit counties from a place they can afford to live. So that's kind of where I'm focused on, and work with the state school board as well as far as methods and other things. There's some issues there that I've heard from constituents they're concerned about, but the legislature's main focus is on funding, and I think we, as far as the tax revenue based on pre-COVID numbers, we had the ability to do that with the increases that were coming, and I would focus on trying to get teacher pay up.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen at the state level. What happens is that the state legislature says, well, if you want to pay your teachers more, to, they'll say this to a school board, raise your taxes. I mean, it just kind of kicks the can down.
Well, there's 2 points. There's local taxes involved in that. I agree with you, but a lot of it comes from the state. And certainly in the past, the state legislature has put a few, shall we say, requirements on it, imposition of some ideas that, you know, if we're going to increase it, but this is kind of where we want it to go, and focus, they can focus on class sizes. Sometimes they've done that and it's worked, but you're right, it can get messed up and changed as it comes down through the management stacks that, as it drops down into the locals. But the state legislature can do what it can, and I think it has the ability to try and get the locals to focus on the issues that they want to put that money to as part of an increase or as part of ongoing funding that they provide every year. That's my intent.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, you're a lifelong resident, as you mentioned, of the Heber Valley. How do those living here in Park City know that you'll look out for their interests?
Same as I would over here. The main thing I've got to do is listen. As I said, I've watched Park City grow like we are now. You're ahead of us several years, or probably 10 or 15 years. But as a young young child, as I grew up, my mom from there and my grandparents lived there. And so I was there a lot as it started to grow, watched some of the changes that take place. We're facing the same thing now. Transportation is a great big one, and just the impact of all the new move-ins. So it's not that I haven't had some experience in that, but I think the biggest part is, as you started out with, is listening. I'm going to, if elected, we'll begin to have meetings over there, Zoom meetings or otherwise, so I get to hear what the people want. I'll also be working closely with elected officials so that we're on the same page. Now, will we always agree? Maybe not. But as your representative, it's my responsibility to weigh that and to represent you in a manner that will be helpful to furthering the policies that especially local elected officials are trying to make happen. And that's what I intend to do.
Okay. Mike, where can people find out more about your campaign?
I have a website. It's MikeKohler2020.com, and my phone number is on there, and I'd invite any of you to call and ask me a question directly about any topic.
All right. I appreciate your time this morning, Mike. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Mike Kohler, again, is looking to serve District 53 of the Utah, 54, excuse me, of the Utah House of Representatives. He is being challenged by Democrat Megan Miller, with whom I'll be speaking tomorrow here on the Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meeting tomorrow, starting at 5:30 via Zoom. On the phone with the preview, I have Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up in work session, a discussion regarding off-street parking standards and maximum building height for master-planned affordable housing developments. This is a report that the Planning Commission will be looking at from the city's consultants, Cascadia Partners, on best practices. Was this done as a way to kind of pave the way for Phase 2 of Woodside Park, which I'm assuming is a qualified MPD affordable housing development?
Yes and no. Woodside Park met all of the current code requirements. This is more of a way, because the City Council and the Planning Commission wanted to figure out what it would take to get more public-private partnerships going so the city did not have to bear the 100% of the burden on building affordable housing.
Okay, well,
yeah. So it's more about the longer range. How do we get the private sector involved? So Cascadia did a study about 6 months ago and delivered it to us. The Planning Commission had some hard questions about more information about public-private partnerships. So we had Cascadia go back and do some additional work and decide where the ROI would lie for a private developer and how much subsidy the city would need to throw into the pie to make a private sector project work.
So back to Woodside Park Phase 2. I mean, if it met code, like you said, then why is it going back to square one? It didn't meet the setbacks.
The appeal on Woodside Park Phase 2 had to do with the way the setback revision was imposed. So it's fairly technical, but basically Woodside Park Phase 2 had a 20-foot setback, which was allowed, but there are specific conditions to allow that. And the approval agencies determined that we had not met those conditions, so we had to go back and replan the project to either a 25-foot setback, which is the code requirement, or come up with better reasons to go to the 20-foot setback. And so that's what they're working on right now.
As part of this study from Cascadia Partners, there was a vehicle ownership study done, and you learned that pretty much 3 out of 4 households have 2 or 3 vehicles. Only 2% of those surveyed have no vehicles. So if we change the off-street parking requirements, where do these cars go if the city isn't making a developer provide the parking for them?
Well, I think that's exactly the right question, Leslie, and that's going to be a debate for the Planning Commission. Where do these cars go? You know, if they go to on-street parking, then it's a, you know, sort of a subsidy by the city to use its own right-of-way to reduce the parking costs. I think Cascadia is probably right that that's probably the biggest cost of doing a development is trying to deliver the correct amount of parking. So, there may be some opportunities in the lower income models to reduce parking, but, you know, these sort of aspirational things to get cars off the road are the right thing to do. I think the tricky bit is when will they come true? So, you know, as you go through the neighborhoods on Sunday morning, you'll see a lot of cars parked in a lot of places that they probably shouldn't be.
And I guess, you know, maybe explain the difference here to me, because the city will not let Deer Valley Resort park on city streets. And Deer Valley Resort certainly provides a lot more benefits to the city than affordable housing units would.
Well, that's kind of something I can't comment on. I think there's going to be an issue with parking and the rate at which we reduce parking.
All right.
It's going to be a long conversation with the Planning Commission, and then it's going to be a long conversation with the City Council before the parking goes away. I think the other thing that the city needs to understand is that Cascadia is making a case to go to 4-story buildings for affordable housing in zones that only allow 2.5 or 3 stories in order to adjust the ROI for a developer. We'll have to have a conversation about where those buildings can go and how they can fit into neighborhoods, and maybe they don't fit into certain neighborhoods.
All right. Also on the agenda, there's an expansion for an ambulatory surgery center at the hospital. I thought we were done with the hospital build out.
Well, yes and no. This was approved a couple of months ago, and the density was approved a couple of months ago. And now all they do is do the final CUP for this. This is part of their master plan to do an ambulatory surgical center. And my understanding is that, you know, medical care is kind of changing so that we don't have quite so many hospital beds, and we have beds that, as it says, ambulatory care, so you can get in and out of there. So it's probably the right thing to do. It's part of their master plan. It's all approved. It's just a matter of getting this conditional use permit approved.
Okay. Last on the agenda, the continued discussion on the Park City Mountain Resort-based parking lots. We now have a sort of think or car-glide group organizing, which hopes that they can tweak things. Where are we with the Planning Commission making a recommendation here?
Well, we keep plowing through the process. You know, we were talking about trying to be ready to go in October or November, but that's not going to happen. you know, tonight's meeting is more about fact-finding with the Planning Commission and making sure that we've asked the right questions of PEG to answer. This is not like the final technical report of what PEG's going to do. This is a question and answer session saying, did you do this? Did you do this? Did you remember to do that with respect to construction management? I mean, we've got some serious construction management issues that need to be resolved. For the most part, PEG has resolved the big engineering issues about putting the cranes on site and all of that, but we don't understand where the construction workers are going to park. So we're going to have to figure that one out. We're going to have to figure out on-time concrete deliveries during the summertime so they're not blocking Lowell Avenue. There's a couple of things that need to be resolved with respect to mountain biking and how that continues to operate. And the city at some point is going to have to build a water tank using the impact fees. And so that's got to figure into the construction management as well. So there's some big questions out there. Alex Planner Anant has tried to respond to the first level of sustainability questions and what PEG is promising to do with their buildings and what the energy standards are and some of the other issues with regard to sustainability. So that's in this document as well. We're working with public utilities to make sure the utility plan is phased in correctly. So this is a question and answer session with the Planning Commission, and then the public will get a chance to comment. We probably will not take a lot of comments on traffic and transportation because that's kind of off topic tonight. But hopefully we get through it with the Planning Commission and they'll give us the information to get to PEG.
So is anything changing in this application as a result of these discussions, or is the applicant just sticking with the project as is?
Probably both. You know, they're trying to come up with some new conceptual opportunities for Parcel B. They're trying to come up with some new conceptual opportunities, for the housing question. But they have not changed their drawings yet until we get through a couple more of these studies, and then we'll see what they're going to change.
Okay.
But, you know, we've had this long conversation about Three Kings Drive and whether there's a stoplight going in at the corner of Lowell and Three Kings, how that roundabout works at the corner of Empire and Three Kings. The drawings haven't changed, even though we're having reasonable conversations about how that wants to change. We have not seen the final report from the city's consultant on whether the roundabout's going to work and whether the traffic light is going to be the right solution in that location. They're also making some comments with respect to one way, and we need to hear from the public.
Well, so given that this issue probably has the most public interest, why is it last on the agenda instead of first on the agenda? I mean, if you want public input, you'd put it first on the agenda so people could talk about it. Now people have to sit through a meeting and really not know when this is going to start.
You know, that's a fair question, Leslie. We used to put this on the front of the agenda, and, you know, and then all the other applicants had to sit through and wait. So we were hoping that, you know, this would be a more efficient way of doing things. It may not be. We've also scheduled, we're in the midst of trying to schedule two additional special meetings in November and December for just PEG in order to move this along and get some of the other stuff cleared off the agenda.
I've got to leave it there.
So I don't disagree with you, Leslie. You may be on the right track here.
Okay. Hey, Bruce, thanks for your time. That's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. You're listening to the Local News Hour.